I traced the history from 1857 through 1862 when these incidents occurred at Massacre Rocks. And what I found was that the Mountain Meadows Massacre was not a one-time anomaly. It was a continuing campaign that went on for another 5 years after 1857 and was brought into southern Idaho and northern Utah. And the same tactics that were used at Mountain Meadows were used in Idaho at Massacre Rocks.
Hey everyone, I hope you're all doing well. In this episode, I speak with Dave Lundgren. Dave is a tribal attorney, and he is the author of the recently released book, Massacre Rocks, A Campaign of Deception. And Dave, as I mentioned, being a tribal attorney, he's been doing that since 1987, and he represents Indian tribes and tribal entities here in the United States. And the background of this book is he was doing historical research in the mid-1980s, and he uncovered some inconsistencies in historical accounts of emigrant massacres along the Oregon Trail that did not reflect official governmental records. Being here in southern Idaho, Dave is also from this region of the U.S. I think he currently lives in Washington, but he grew up in the Pocatello area. Of course, I live here in southern Idaho as well. So the stuff that he brings up in his book, the research that he did into these events that happened in the late 19th century in this region felt particularly relevant, considering that, you know, some of the things that he discusses in this involves Mormon settlers and other white immigrants coming to this region as, of course, the settler colonialist project that is the United States of America began to really expand to the Pacific. The land that I live on currently, that much of southern Idaho encompasses, is the Shoshone-Bannock territory. This book uncovers, as I stated there, some historical inconsistencies. So I'll read a little more of this description here. In recent years, Dave has analyzed those records and books on the local history in southern Idaho, and what he found has profound modern-day implications. The accounts revealed a coordinated propaganda campaign supported by entrenched institutional racism designed to hide the identity of the real culprits of the terrorist attacks. The propaganda is pervasive, and in this book, he traces the history and the continuing campaign of hate and deception in southern Idaho. He points to some of the markers, like some of the historical landmarks in this area that have been identified by the state. You know, of course, they have these sort of scenic locations that you can go to that, of course, are historical markers in this region. He points to a small roadside sign along the highway at the site of the Bear River Massacre, which was one of the largest massacres of Native Americans in this country's history, but merely alerts travelers to a, quote, point of interest without any detail. And on the other hand, Idaho's Massacre Rocks State Park, where white immigrants were murdered along the Oregon Trail, has large signs along the freeway that perpetuate the myth that Native Americans were the killers. They were not, but the Northern Shoshone paid the ultimate price for the fraud. I think it's a pretty good rundown of what Dave points to in his research, which is an ongoing, as he says, a campaign of deception, a propaganda campaign to disseminate a particular myth that, you know, in the case of Massacre Rocks, that location, there was a story that has been told for a long time, which is that Chief Pocatello, which, by the way, wasn't his real name, that he and a band of Shoshones had murdered some immigrants that were passing through that region along, again, on the Oregon Trail. What Dave points to and what he explains in this interview, and of course what he writes about in his book, is that in fact what the evidence shows, the inconsistencies in the historical record, which he identified, it's very unlikely, in fact, altogether false, that the Shoshones was responsible for that massacre. In fact, there's a lot more evidence to indicate that it was Mormon settlers that had done that. And this is a pattern. You know, we see this in this region where Mormons settled, where they attacked immigrants that were moving out west, and they also attacked indigenous peoples in Idaho as well as in the Utah region. How does this information play into the present? I think I may have stated there this has profound implications for the present time. So we talk about how in areas in which Mormons in particular settled, a lot of these stories and myths about, you know, who was actually responsible for these massacres, you know, this hasn't been really fully acknowledged by white settlers in this region. There's, again, this whole mythology, this whole story that's been told about this that is just isn't true. How this plays out into the present day is really interesting. You know, if you've been paying attention to some of the controversy around some of the mascots for some of the major league sports teams, there was the Washington Redskins. They changed their name because that name, I'm not going to say it, but it's basically, it's an incredibly derogatory and racist term that has been normalized, seemingly normalized in the U.S. culture, where, you know, you even have a major league football team that is calling themselves the Redskins. Now, just this year, they decided to change that. And we've also seen, I think, with the Cleveland Indians, I think that's a baseball team. I don't know very much about sports, to be honest with you, but I believe they're going to change their name. As Dave wrote about in a recent article he published at the Idaho State Journal, he wrote about how the book, I'm actually going to quote this really quick, the book was completed just before the Pocatello School District voted to end the use of the Indians mascot at Pocatello High School earlier this year, but the book Massacre Rock sheds light on local views towards Native Americans that makes the use of the Indian-themed mascots in the region so widespread. And also, it's worth noting as well that Massacre Rocks, the book, also links the tactics of modern domestic terrorists by white supremacists with those used in the 1800s, and he warns that a failure to address organized hate quickly and decisively can have grave consequences. So he makes those connections in his book. As I note, being someone here in southern Idaho, I can tell you that it's really, you know, once you start to see it, it's kind of hard to not see it anymore. Of course, being a privileged white person in this region, you know, you can very easily look away from this and not address it. You know, we can very easily kind of exist in a sort of amnesia, historical amnesia, if we want. You know, we can just not look at the fact that we have numerous schools, numerous high schools around this region, whether we're talking about Idaho or Utah, in which the mascots are often, you know, native themed. It's just, it's like how the genocide that has been perpetuated against indigenous peoples in this region, those myths that are built around that are still playing out into the present and are represented in school mascots. I mean, this is a big part of how I think with the settler culture in this region has attempted to downplay and make an actual mockery of the indigenous peoples that have lived on this land for thousands of years before people like us came along. This is making light of a very grave and deeply significant historical event that is still playing out to the present. Genocide is not just this one-off thing where you eradicate an entire group of people. It's also in how the story is told later on, and the fact that we still have, you know, indigenous people that live here, and they're not being adequately respected. It's very offensive and just really in poor, poor taste, and just downplay something that, you know, really only happened, you know, these massacres that we're kind of addressing in this interview, that happened so... It was so recent. It wasn't that long ago at all. It was very, very recent. Only a few generations ago did this happen. And we're, I don't know, it's just incredibly, it's disturbing to really deal with the gravity of this, you know? I really don't have a lot of good words for it. I don't know how to really adequately talk about my feelings about it. But, you know, I just really wanted to talk to Dave about this book. I really feel like he did an excellent job of uncovering this history and just elaborating on it in really clear language So I really thank him for writing the book. I really thank him for agreeing to do this interview with me. And if you would like to learn more about Massacre Rocks, A Campaign of Deception, I would just ask that you check out the Amazon link. That's where it's currently being sold. So if you go to the link, I'll have that down in the description. You can buy a physical copy or a ebook, a digital copy as well. If you would like to support my work specifically, this podcast, there's a couple ways to do that. The first thing is just if you want to learn anything about this work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you'd like to support this work monetarily, you can do that through two means. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal or Venmo. You can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. Those donations are extremely helpful. So to those that have done that, thank you very much. And if you'd like to support this work on a regular monthly basis, you can do that through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness, you can contribute monthly. You can do as little as $1 a month or however much you want to do, and you'll gain early access to these interviews before the public release. You also gain some other exclusive content there as well. To everyone that has supported this work, whether you subscribe and share or like however you choose to support it, I see it and I really, really thank you for it. So thank you very, very much. All right, everyone, thank you so much for your attention. And without any further delay, here is my interview with Dave Lundgren. All right. Well, Dave, thank you very much for joining me for this interview. I, as I mentioned earlier before we started recording, a friend of the podcast had sent me a link to, actually it was your Facebook page for your book, Massacre Rocks, A Campaign of Deception. And then I think from there I found an article you had published recently, I think just this last month, at Idaho State Journal. The title of that article is Local History About Pocatello Is Wrong. And I could just imagine people reading that in this state of Idaho and being a bit taken aback, maybe. Possibly by the things that you posit, the things that you present in your book and in that article about Pocatello, about Southern Idaho and the history of this region, and all the things you touch on in that, I can just imagine that that there must have been some kind of feedback. Did you receive any, like, what kind of feedback did you get so far from your book and from
what you
published? I've
gotten mostly nothing but positive feedback.
Oh, that's good.
There was a couple of snide comments made in the in response to the article that appeared in the Idaho State Journal on Pocatello. But other than that, feedback has been real positive.
That's good. Yeah, and I think part of why I asked it that way is that you talk about in that article. And I think you mentioned that this happened also right as you were publishing your book, that Pocatello, which is named supposedly after Chief Pocatello, and I actually want you to get into that history a bit because there's a lot of misconceptions and misinformation surrounding this individual that we call Chief Pocatello, which the city of Pocatello was named after. But, you know, the mascot of Pocatello High School was, I think up until just this year, was the Indians. Is that right?
That is right. Yes.
Yeah. There has been this like wave of change. I mean, this year we've seen finally the Washington, it's basically a racial slur. So I'll just say our skins, they're changing their name. I just found out recently, I guess, was it the Cleveland Indians are changing their name as well.
Right.
And as I mentioned also, like you mentioned how in Southern Idaho, and in, I think just in this part of the country in general, there's a lot of mascots of these like local high schools that are like, you know, Indians or, I mean, there's all kinds of these names that these high schools have, which are really pretty racist caricatures of indigenous peoples in this region. So I just found that part really fascinating, but you tie that into a deeper history of this region. So I guess I'm kind of wandering all over the place here, but if you could talk a bit about why did you focus on talking about these mascots, and how does that tie specifically into this region and the violence that indigenous people have experienced here? Like, what does that represent to you when you look at a racist caricature of an indigenous person or indigenous peoples represented in mascots? Like, what does that point to you? Like, where does that come from?
Well, I think it's symptomatic of a widely held view within that region of the country that Native people are inferior. Mm-hmm. And I had been looking at this since I went to Pocatello High School, and always felt that it was a wrong thing to do to minimize a culture of a rich culture of people by displaying caricatures, stereotypical caricatures, and pretending to engage in war dances and that kind of thing. It just always bothered me.
Yeah.
And so I had been following the mascot issue at Pocatello High School for a while. But I became a tribal attorney and became more interested in the connection between the use of Indian mascots in high schools with the general view of Native people. And I had done research in southern Idaho for some tribes at Fort Hall. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of the history, local history, was inaccurate, at mm-hmm. least the commonly known history, because it didn't reflect what was actually laid out in official records of particularly the military records of the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And I learned that Brigham Madsen was the primary author of numerous books of this era or this region regarding Mormons and their relationship with Native people. Mm. And it was simply wrong. So I am near the end of my career, and I thought, well, you know, I need to tell this story. So I decided to write this book.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the mythology or the propaganda? You described it as a propaganda campaign to sort of falsely present certain events that happened out west. What exactly is the story that we're told? Like, what is the story? How is it presented to us? And what did you discover actually happened? The title of your book is Massacre Rocks, and that's kind of the focal point. If you could talk about that event and like how it's presented to us, to the public more widely, and like what you actually discovered in researching that event.
Sure. Well, Massacre Rocks is about 10 miles west of American Falls. It's a state park maintained by the state of Idaho. Mm-hmm. In 1862, there was a massacre of a group of a couple of massacres, actually, that occurred near that area of immigrants traveling through from the east, heading for California and Oregon. The portrayal at Massacre Rock State Park was that Pocatello, who was a Shoshone leader in the 1800s, led a small band of Shoshones against the immigrants and slaughtered them. Hmm. What I found was that Pocatello was not his true name. That was a fabricated name that was created by the Mormon Church. His name was Tomeazo, but the interpreter couldn't interpret it, couldn't pronounce it, so he assigned him the name Pocatello. So the whole name is fake.
Well, that name is, I just want to comment that name, Pocatello, is so different from
it is.
His actual name. Like, how do you misinterpret that? That's crazy. I'm sorry.
Well, he made it up. Because he couldn't pronounce his name, so he just gave him a fake name.
Okay. All right. Sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, I just had a comment on that.
That's fine. So what I found in my historical research was that Pocatello was actually determined by the military to have played no role in attacking immigrants. And this kind of led me into researching the Mountain Meadows Massacre of September 9th in 1857 that occurred in southern Utah, where Mormon leaders dressed as Indians and went in and slaughtered 120 immigrants from Arkansas. Mm-hmm. The real history of that is only recently coming to light, and the actual role that the Mormon Church played in not only carrying it out, but covering it up with propaganda, particularly through the Deseret News, the Mormon newspaper in mm-hmm. Salt Lake. Mm. So I traced the history from 1857 through 1862 when these incidents occurred at Massacre Rocks. And what I found was that the Mountain Meadows Massacre was not a one-time anomaly. It was a continuing campaign that went on for another 5 years after 1857 and was brought into southern Idaho and northern Utah. And the same tactics that were used at Mountain Meadows were used in Idaho at Massacre Rocks.
So did Mormon settlers dress up as Native peoples in all these incidences, these massacres as
yes,
well?
Yes, they did.
I think you mentioned this in maybe your book, we think about the Boston Tea Party, you know, leading up to the revolution in the 18th century. And those people, they were white people. They dressed up as natives, so to speak. They put on red paint and all of that, and they went and they dumped all that tea in the harbor, right? So what does that mean? Like, why do settlers do this? Like, why do they dress up as Native people? Is it a way to kind of frame these events, like, and put it on them, like it's their fault? Or is it just like, what do you think the purpose of that is?
it varies. And there's a really good book called Playing Indian by Philip DeLoria that goes into that history from the Boston Tea Party on through the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and the high school mascots, use of the mascots for to minimize the culture. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any one reason for it. It's just very common in this country to mimic Native people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I just want to say this because it's like there are so many, as you reference in your work, there's so many references to, in the West in particular, of just this sort of violent history. Like you mentioned something, and I wanted to actually flesh this out a little bit because I want to know more about it. Because you talk about red face portrayals at pioneer celebrations. And I mean, where I'm at in southern Idaho, in this area, in Twin Falls County, there is this thing called Western Days, which they do every year, which is just a celebration of pioneers settling out west and all that, and there's that whole thing. But I haven't seen anything regarding red face. But like, what celebrations or pioneer celebrations are you referring to in which people dress up in red face?
A more recent incident involved the community of Wellsville, Utah.
Okay.
They would have their Pioneers Day celebration every year, and they would dress up in red face and dress up as Indians and portray an attack on a wagon train of immigrants in the park. And it would be done every year. It was done for over 100 years.
Wow.
And a writer for the Salt Lake Tribune got wind of it and went and videotaped one of these events and wrote a column about it in 2017 in the Salt Lake Tribune. And they caught a lot of flack for that. And they really defended it as being a longstanding tradition that shouldn't be questioned. But people started saying, well, you know, this is more like the Mountain Meadows Massacre than it is Indians attacking white people.
Yeah.
And I think when they recognized that this was resurrecting the truth, that they were actually portraying what they really did, they stopped it.
Wow. I just have to just sit with that for a second. Like they were actually, like they thought they were, just want to comment on this. So they dress up in red face. They wear a bunch of the very offensive garb, you know, appropriating indigenous peoples. So they dress that up. They then act out a scenario where this actually happened, where immigrants were massacred. And they're trying to portray it as if they're Indians that did it, Native American people did it. But actually, they're just portraying what actually literally happened, which is settlers dressed up as in red face and then actually killed immigrants. Like, that's literally what happened.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, my God. Oh, sorry. I just had to reflect on that. That's like kind of almost, it's ironic in all the worst ways, I guess.
Yeah, and it's common. It's common in this whole region that Mormons will do that. They'll dress up as Indians and portray these attacks. And so with this kind of story, this whole generally accepted view is being perpetuated by these celebrations and at Massacre Rocks. They keep representing that Native people were savages that brutally attacked women and children and slaughtered people, when in fact it was the Mormons who were doing it.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make just a note here. So I grew up Mormon. I left the church in my early 20s. I'm now like in my early 30s. So I stopped going to church when I was like 18 or something. And I kind of, you know, that was really when I was questioning the whole faith and religion that I grew up with. And then as I like got a little older and I had a little bit of a distance from it, I was able to then go back and research it from a more objective point of view, because I was less emotionally charged. You know, I had a lot of issues with the church and a lot of conflicted feelings. But once I had some separation from it over time, I could actually like, oh, let's actually look at the actual history, not from Mormon historians, but from people who can just like look at it as it really is. And a lot of stuff came up that I was just really, I don't know if I was surprised, but it was something, there was just a lot of things that I was just like, wow, I had no idea about this history. And there's just also something about when Mormons settled out west, there's just this whole history that's just not acknowledged. And so how would you describe Mormon settlers and their relationship with indigenous peoples in the places they settled in the west? I mean, what was their general attitude or relationship towards Native populations here?
Well, to understand that, I had to research the history in relation to Native people. And so my second chapter of my book goes into that, the history of the Mormons, Mormon Church, and the movement into Salt Lake, into the Salt Lake Basin. It was pretty interesting, actually. One of the things that you need to understand about the Mormon faith is that Joseph Smith, and you, I'm sure you know this with your background, but Joseph Smith was of the view and put into the Book of Mormon that the fact that Mormons were from Israel. And you wonder, how is that? I mean, why is that? Well, in the 1820s, 1830s, anti-Semitism was very prevalent in this country and in Europe. And I think he tapped into this underlying resentment that people had towards Jewish people.
Yeah.
And so, and Native people for that matter. So he made Natives Jews. And it really caught on. So the Book of Mormon actually expressly states that Native people are inferior and whites are superior.
Yes.
So with that view, it makes sense that they would take no issue with portraying Native people in their high schools and teaching the young that Native culture is something to be minimized and mocked. When they moved to the Salt Lake Basin, I go into the history of brief history, and I wanted to relate it to the relationship between the Mormon Church and Native people. They quickly realized that they weren't going to convert the local natives to Mormonism. So they abandoned the idea and instead engaged in a process of snatching up Native children and bringing them into the white homes and proselytize them in the Mormon teachings as young people growing up. There was another tribe, I don't recall which tribe it was, but they were actually stealing Mormon children, Native Paiute and Shoshone children from the different tribes, and they were selling them to Mormons. And this was done in around 1849, 1850, in that era.
Yeah.
Well, this policy of indoctrinating Native children in the Mormon religion that started in the 1840s and 50s continued on and has been very prevalent in this country. And Congress finally had to step in the 1970s and try to put a stop to it. It's called the Indian Child Welfare Act. It was to try to prevent these forced adoptions and removal of children from Indian homes. And Congress was informed of the devastating effects that had on children being removed, yeah, both from their parents and their cultures. It had a devastating effect. So yeah, Congress passed the statute in 76, I believe, 78. There's been a very strenuous effort on the part of those who seek to adopt Native children to try to overturn that statute. Mm-hmm. They've been fighting it, litigating it for years. In 1989, it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld the act as being constitutional, and it was necessary to prevent these forced adoptions. There's another case pending right now in Texas that is likely to end up in the Supreme Court, another challenge to the Indian Child Welfare Act. So that effort is continuing.
Well, that's just amazing that I think there's just this false view, and this is, I mean, in regards to just racism and white supremacy, I mean, there's just this view that with indigenous peoples in this country, it's like, oh, that was in the past. Like, we're not doing that anymore. It basically engaging in genocidal practices, you know, that's the past, but it's happening, as you just mentioned there. I mean, it's happening up to the present. And absolutely, I imagine being a tribal attorney, you're like, oh yeah, there's so many examples of this just in the present day that people are just pretty, I mean, I would say I'm oblivious to, and I think many, many people are oblivious to as well. You know,
absolutely.
It's just worth commenting on. Yeah. Well, I also want to ask, I mean, these Mormon settlers, they attacked immigrants. These are people that were also, you know, white or of European descent that were coming across the North American continent and trying to settle, you know, out west, whether that was in California or wherever. And they obviously were attacking these people. So what's that about? Why were Mormons so hostile? I say Mormons in a very general sense, but like Mormon settlers at this time, why were they so hostile to immigrants moving out west?
Well, you've heard of neo-Nazis in current times.
Oh yeah.
One of their intents is to start a race war.
Mm-hmm.
The intent was to convince the general public that Native people were savages and they would attack these people, so that they ought to be wiped out. And another tactic they used was they would use strychnine and arsenic, the Mormon settlers did, to poison water holes and livestock. They would put arsenic in an ox and leave it dead, so people would get it and eat the meat and die. Many people died that way. Many Native people died that way. But the intent was to get the natives riled up, so they would go after the settlers, go after the immigrants. So that was a campaign that went on for a short while, the poisoning, but the local Native people were quick to realize who was doing it. And once Brigham Young found out that particularly Pocatello called him on it, called his interpreter on it and said, look, you're poisoning my people. I'm not going to help you defend against advancing army troops who were on their way to stop the practices of polygamy and the criminal activities that the Mormons were engaged in. Mm-hmm. So Brigham Young put a stop to that poisoning campaign, but continued the Red Face campaign up into the mid-1860s.
Mm. That was it. Was that actually those massacres where Mormons dressed up as in Red Face? Was that actually endorsed by Brigham Young? I'm just curious. Like, how high up did this go as far as these massacres?
Will Bagley wrote Blood of the Prophets in 2002, I believe, addressed that and uncovered evidence that it came from the top, that John D. Lee was leading the effort at Mountain Meadows and would dispatch messengers by horseback up to Salt Lake to get direction on what to do. And what happened was when they cornered these settlers from these immigrants from Arkansas, he dispatched a messenger to Brigham Young to find out what they ought to do. And so the message that John Lee sent to Young has been removed from the church archives, but there is a response that Brigham Young sent back to Lee, and he said, do not interfere with them. Let the Indians do what they will, basically.
Hmm.
And so in light of the fact that he then slaughtered them in Red Face, lets you know that what kind of messaging was going on. But it was very clear that Brigham Young was directing the campaign. Mm. And effectively prevented justice from being accomplished until 19 years after the event. So much pressure was being put on Brigham Young that he finally relented and offered up John D. Lee as the sole culprit, and even helped supply evidence and to the prosecutors and witnesses, but he only did it on the condition that the prosecutors would hold the church harmless in the incident.
Mm. I just have to just comment because as I said, I grew up LDS, and I've had several interviews with people to kind of unpack my own, I guess, feelings or my own experiences with the church and questions that I started having when I was young, and just some of the things that we hear about. I mean, I remember the Mountain Meadows massacre had been talked about in circles growing up, but there was always this like, oh, this is just a story that, yes, it happened, but it wasn't as bad as these historians are saying, and you know, that this is really just anti-Mormon propaganda
right.
that's being spread. And so it was interesting growing up in this religion, because in this sort of this religious community, because it's like anything that challenged the official narrative of the LDS Church, of like how Mormons settled out west and the whole story. It's like basically it's a mythology that's been cultivated over however many decades now. And there's just things that are excluded from that story because it's really inconvenient to talk about certain things that happened. And I just remember growing up having that reflection of like, something isn't being said here. And right. there's something also like, I mean, just with like the implicit ingrained racism that is a part of the LDS theology. You talked about, Joseph Smith, of course, the founder of the church, and how he wrote into the Book of Mormon. And people don't realize this maybe, but like Native American peoples are seen as being Lamanites, descendants of these people that are written about in the Book of Mormon, who more often than not were wicked and bad and were constantly in battle with the good people, which were the Nephites. And the right. Nephites were light-skinned. They had fair skin, lighter skin, because they were more righteous. They were closer to God. And then the Lamanites had darker skin because they were cursed, because they were further away from God and God's word, and they were, you know, evil. So there was exactly. like literally written into the Book of Mormon, the founding text of the LDS Church, is that if you have dark skin, you are cursed.
Like, exactly.
It's
exactly.
written into it. And I just remember growing up thinking like, this is really not like not politically correct, or something's really not right in this view. And anyway, I just had to comment on just my own exploration of this subject. Is just like peeling back this like onion. And the more that I peel back, the more horrified I am by the religion that I grew up in, you know? Did you grow up LDS, Dave?
No, I didn't.
You didn't? No, okay.
I didn't. And I don't have any ill feelings towards the Mormon Church. I didn't do this to go after the Mormon Church. I just did sure. it to go after the truth.
Right, of course. Yeah, I mean, reading it, I'm not reading this, because there are certainly, I think there is something to say about anti-Mormon propaganda. There is absolutely these people that are just vehemently hateful towards Mormons, where it's completely irrational, and I don't feel that way at all about Mormons. I grew up with Mormons. My family's Mormon. I have not a horrible relationship at all with the church. I just am deeply critical of all religions and religious institutions, and I think the Mormon Church is unique in its crimes and how they've attempted to kind of walk back or like cover up certain events in their history. And it's not that unique. I mean, I'm sure you could look to any major religion that's ever existed, and I'm sure that that's the case, right? I mean, it's not unique to the Mormon Church in that regard, but I want to ask this, because something that I've been really making connections with is I do talk about the rise of white domestic terrorism, white nationalism, white supremacy in the U.S., especially over the past several years. And I mean, you mentioned that pretty bluntly in the beginning of your book, that the United States, the people of the United States, have yet to really come to terms with that reality. What connections do you see with contemporary white terrorism and this history of Mormon settlers and all of that? I mean, what is the connection there for
well,
you?
Well, the leaderless resistance is the term the neo-Nazis use now. Timothy McVeigh was one of those people. They sign into the doctrines, the hatred, the resistance, and they're not given explicit direction on how to carry out specific attacks against churches or other institutions, mm-hmm. Like the Oklahoma City bombing, federal building bombing in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. but they're taught to hate, and they're given the tools to carry out these acts. And so that's been going on since, well, Timothy McVeigh, that was in the 90s, and we're still seeing it. We're still seeing these massacres at synagogues and churches. So it's very similar. Yeah. You have the Mormons were teaching hatred for people of dark skin, that they were cursed by God. And so it was okay to carry out these acts. But the other, the more interesting thing about the Mormon Church is that the church required tithings from their followers, and 10% tithing. Mm-hmm. So these immigrants were carrying cash. So cash was going back to the church after these attacks. This was a financial connection to these attacks. And then the church was protecting them through the Deseret News, so that you can track these stories in the Deseret News that falsely claim that Indians were being the perpetrators, when in fact their followers were being carrying out these acts of terrorism.
Okay. Yeah. So do you see that the tactics that maybe Mormon settlers were using to against immigrants and towards indigenous peoples, like, that carries over to the present in some way? Like, is there some pattern there? Yeah,
I do. Yeah. And the failure to react, to respond to the source of the problem, when you have these hate groups, and it's only recently, just this last year, been recognized as a national threat priority by the FBI. And that, you know, that was, it's been over 20 years since the Oklahoma City bombing, and that was motivated by hate.
Yeah. Yeah. This country is, it's just like when you peel back the history of the Mormon Church, you just peel back the history of this whole region and this country. It's like, this is a nation that was built on almost a white reactionary, I don't know what the word is, reactionaryism or something, or there's some like deep thing here with white settlers and white people that carries over into the present, where there's just this like urge to engage in really horribly violent acts of terror against, I mean, whether it's, you know, with, you mentioned Timothy McVeigh, but I mean, attacking synagogues, attacking mosques, attacking, you know, people of color, black churches. It's interesting. It's like this mentality that carries over into the present. And this actually ties a bit to the mascot thing and the red face. Is I think of colonizers, and how even though it's been over 100 years or less than 100 years since a lot of these major incidents of massacres and genocidal campaigns occurred, but there are these like cultural artifacts that get carried into the present, where if you know how to look and see it, you'll see like, oh, this is directly related to this horribly violent series of events that led up to the present moment. Like, when I, like, for instance, like, we talk about the mascot thing, some people just say like, oh, it's not a big deal. Like, what is it? It's just a mascot. But for people that are aware of the history, and if you are, especially if you're indigenous, you look at that, like, that is a reminder of something that happened, that, and it just, it speaks to this sort of cultural or historical amnesia that the dominant culture tends to have about these things. And it just directly ties to that violent history of white reactionary terrorism that we've seen, as you documented, all the way back to Mormon settlers coming here in the 1800s. I just feel like there's this kind of connection there. And
yeah, you raise a really good point, Patrick. In fact, the Constitution, address it, it was designed around that concept, and the Constitution was derived from international law in large part, and actually from doctrines announced by the Catholic Church in the 1200s. The view of the Catholic Church was that Native people were to be, if they were not Christian, they were meant to be subjugated, and their lands were meant to be taken because they weren't of the Christian faith. And so that was carried forward on into the Constitution, and the Constitution was a stress between annihilation and treaty making, recognition of tribes as nations, which they ended up doing. They ended up treating tribes as nations under the Constitution, so the treaties would be entered into the Native nations. We were fortunate that it went that way, but even that was ended in the 1871 by Congress. Congress stopped treaty making. So by statute, which I think is unconstitutional, Congress stopped treaty making.
Interesting. Well, I mean, are you at all encouraged by, I mean, I have this sort of pull between something I almost describe like it's performative politics, where certainly, like, you know, changing the names of these mascots and ending these red face pioneer celebrations and all this is good ultimately, but it does often feel a bit performative in the sense of like, yeah, we'll make it look good, we'll stop these really insensitive practices, but you know, fundamentally, structurally, nothing's really going to change. Like, how do you feel about that? In the idea of, we're gonna stop using these offensive mascots, but we're not actually going to address like the systemic issues surrounding indigenous peoples, their nations, their tribes, their ability to assert autonomy, you know, in whatever form that comes in. I mean, being a tribal attorney as long as you have been, I mean, like, where do tribes, indigenous people stand as far as being adequately represented in maybe in the United States in general, or maybe just out here in the West?
Yeah, and I'm not in a position to speak for tribes.
Sure.
But in my experience, I see this as an important step. These mascots are symbols, and if those symbols represent our full extent of knowledge about a people, that's just wrong. So I think this is a good step, and I think it comes right out of the Black Lives Matter movement and the George Floyd massacre that occurred right in front of our eyes. These are, sometimes you have to take small steps to get to the larger goal. And I think this is an important one, very important one. It may be symbolic, but I think it's real important.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I was just curious. I like both things. I mean, I am not saying that it's all performative. I think that you know, symbolic gestures are important because it actually points to a deeper cultural shift that we might be experiencing. And we may be able to address more systemic issues from that point. I see that. I see that as being a potential outcome of all of this. And like, make a question. I'll just say this. In the town that I live in, I'm not going to say the name of it on this recording, but I do live in a small town in southern Idaho where the mascot of the local high school is the Indians. like Pocatello, you mentioned in the beginning, Pocatello High School decided to change their mascot. Do you think that that's going to happen with other schools? I mean, these are really conservative white areas of the state and of the country. Do you think that they're going to, like, what is your general sense of that, I guess? I'm just curious what your general reading of the situation is with other
areas. Well, I'm heartened by what's happening. The first one was Driggs. They used our skins as their mascot. And they decided on their own to retire that mascot. Boise High School, I believe, had the Braves. They're going to change it to Brave, which I guess is some improvement.
Okay. All right.
So, I mean, that's three.
Yeah.
Out of the several that there are in the state.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing. I think people are coming to realize, and you know, when the, like, getting back to the George Floyd killing, that we also was brought into our living rooms. I think people, you know, they drew the connection. Mm-hmm. They see the connection that, you know, if our police don't honor all human beings similarly, maybe, you know, what we're doing, our symbols are not honoring the people the way we should.
Right.
And I was, you know, one of the things that really was enlightening to me was to learn that modern day police forces derived from slave patrols.
Yeah.
In the 1780s. Mm-hmm. And when you recognize that, you can see that a culture was brought up within law enforcement of that kind of mentality, that blacks were to be seized.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the same thing coming from black communities being fearful of police.
Yep.
Because of the history of slave patrols.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff to me, but
yeah. Yeah, it ties into systemic, or like deeply systemic issues. You know, just the uprisings that we saw across the United States this year, relating to Black Lives Matter and to the killing of George Floyd and so many other people of color that have been brutalized and murdered by police. I mean, it draws, there's a deep history there that a lot of people, I think, are starting to come to terms with. It's starting to happen. And I think, like, it's interesting. I just think of this almost hierarchy of, I guess, race in this country where, like, talk about the red face thing. People dressing up in indigenous people's garb, you know, these really offensive costumes with red face. Like, the fact that there's still people that are doing that, like, you would never see, hardly ever, blackface. Like, blackface is so taboo now, but apparently red face and dressing up in, you know, the indigenous people's garb, which is really offensive, is still kind of tolerated in many places, I think. It's just...
accepted.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, the hierarchy there. Like, again, you would not be acceptable. It is not acceptable. Like, anytime you see a story of a politician, like, oh, back in college, they were in a frat house or something and they put on blackface, and it's just like so bad. But hardly do we see that same level of controversy surrounding redface and other really offensive depictions of indigenous peoples. It's
right. Because yeah. We've been desensitized to it by culture.
Right.
By our own culture.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember a story of a native guy was telling me a story of his view of Indians was looking up on in grade school at the ABCs on the ribbon that was above the chalkboard. And when it came to I for Indian, there was a little Indian kid with a feather sticking out, you know, a headband with a feather sticking out. And that was his view of his culture. And that's something that we all grew up with.
Yeah, it's so deeply ingrained, and it's just it's good to see, like, your book coming out. I think it's really important that people like you are doing this kind of work and uncovering a very inconvenient reality for a lot of people. It's really important that we're just honest, because there's no way that we can really move forward culturally, collectively, unless we just have an honest assessment of how we got here with all the horrors that came with that. We cannot effectively move forward and potentially heal from this without just being really, really blunt and honest about what happened here. On the lands, on the lands that we live on, like land that I live on,
and that's why I wrote this book. That generally accepted view in the town of Pocatello, that Pocatello was a savage killer, is just wrong. But it's prevalent. It's in the historical works of Brigham Madsen. It's in a history book of an author I really respect, Clinton Phoenix from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, Pocatello's website, and then also the state of Idaho perpetuating this myth at Massacre Rock State Park. If you look at papers of the Idaho State Historical Society, they're the same view. They're the same view, and they coordinated with Brigham Madsen to get the church's story out. And that was a really interesting find that I made, was that the Idaho State Historical Society's paper on Massacre Rocks, and anybody can Google it and pull it up, has the church's view of that massacre. One of the interesting things they talk about is that, and apparently these papers were written with the help of volunteers over the years. And so it was obvious that settler volunteers offered up information about some of these attacks in the Massacre Rocks area. But one of the interesting facts that they revealed was how much money was taken. There was one in particular was $15,000. And in the 1860s, that was worth over $300,000 in today's value. So to assign a number, a dollar value to what was taken from people who are dead, only the people who took the money would know that information. And that also shows the level of support that was shifted to the church, the Mormon church. They would have got $1,500, which in today's value would be about $38,000. So these weren't small attacks. But the point is this fallacy that Pocatello was responsible permeates all of Idaho's history, and it's wrong. And if you get the real record that I cite throughout my book with footnotes, you see that it's just simply wrong.
Yeah. Your book is really well researched, and you are just pointing to, I mean, this isn't conjecture. I mean, of course you're putting your opinion in there, but your opinion is informed by the information that you have gathered. Right. So,
right.
You know, exactly. When I read that, I'm like, yeah, obviously you're very passionate about what you're writing about, but you're citing like facts. you're looking into a real thing. And of course that's going to inform your perspective, and your opinion on the subject.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Dave, I'm running out of questions. I haven't read your full book yet. As I mentioned, I was able to read just the beginning of it, but already, I'm so fascinated. I want to dig into it more.
Good.
And, yeah,
it's available on Amazon.
Yeah. I was going to say they can buy a physical copy, a printed copy, or there's also the ebook, which is available as well. So people can check that out. And also this article that you published at Idaho State Journal, which is local history about Pocatello was wrong. It was a really good overview of the book, in a very general kind of, you really do a good job of encapsulating and also bringing the subject up to the present. Regarding especially mascots and all of that. What are you up to now? Like, what's your next step now that you've got this book project wrapped up and out and published and everything? What's the next step for you?
Thinking about another book.
Oh yeah.
Thinking about another book. You're looking for ideas.
Oh, okay. So you're in that really early creative phase of trying to figure out what to even talk about. Okay. Yeah, for sure. Yep. Well, Dave, I will be putting all these resources in the show notes and the description of this episode. And I really thank you for your work and for having this discussion with me. I really appreciate your time.
You bet, Patrick. Thank you.